I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Christina LaFont, Harold H. and Virginia Anderson Professor of Philosophy at Northwestern University. We're discussing her 2020 book, Democracy Without Shortcuts, A Participatory Conception of Deliberative Democracy, from Oxford University Press. LaFont's research focuses on normative questions in political philosophy concerning democracy and citizen participation, global governance, human rights, religion, and politics. She is the author of 6 books on critical and democratic theory, as well as many articles. So, first of all, Christina LaFont, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Christina, I loved reading the book, Democracy Without Shortcuts. I love the idea of having a participatory, combining participatory elements in democracy with deliberative elements in democracy. It's great to see the combination of those two democratic traditions, sort of long overdue. Let me ask you first, before we dive into the arguments of the book, for you to maybe say a little bit about what the motivation was for writing the book in the first place.
So I have been working and writing about democracy for 2 decades almost, but just articles and things like this. And democracy is a topic that is very close to my heart. I grew up in Franco's dictatorship in Spain and made it through the transition to democracy. And so that has always been very important to me. However, I had not planned to write a book about democracy. And the reason is that democratic theory is very much state-centric, because we only have democracies at the state level. And so I thought that in the wake of globalization, democratic theory was missing a lot of where the action was. And so my work was more focused on the global and the transnational, and I still continue doing that. And so I thought that what was most needed was not so much improving existing democracies at the state level, but to democratize political decision-making at the transnational and global levels, right? However, the current crisis of democracy has shaken my assumption that we can take democracy for granted at the state level, at least among the richest countries, and worry only about how to extend democracy everywhere else. I'm really afraid that for the first time in my life, ever since Spain made it to democracy, that the future of democracy really is at stake, that we may lose democracy everywhere in the face of Earth. And that is what got me really the kind of urgency to write this book. I know it's state-centric. I know that is insufficient. But I do think we need to defend the currently existing democracies, even at the state level. And that may be a difference with other people who work in democratic theory, because I have the impression that people who have been living in democracies that are long-standing, right, for decades or centuries even, maybe much more concerned about the defects of democracy, right? The things that don't really work, and may have forgotten how important it is to have democracy, however defective, compared to any alternative. And so I see democracies as an extraordinary experiment in the history of humanity of empowering ordinary citizens so that they have some real influence in political decisions. And the problem right now is that citizens are rapidly losing that power because there has been, as I will call them, too many shortcuts built that enable powerful actors to make political decisions while bypassing the citizenry. The citizenry can simply be ignored. And in democratic countries in particular, citizens still have their formal political rights. They can vote, so to say, but those rights seem to no longer reflect real power to influence the decisions to which they are subject. And so the citizens don't see themselves represented by the political system. And that is at least how I read the current populist backlash that we are witnessing in many democratic countries. And that shows us the real danger that we may lose democracy soon. And so I think that those of us who are lucky enough to live in democratic societies have an extraordinary responsibility. We have to get it right. A lot is at stake. We need to pay attention. We need to make sure we don't lose something that we may never be able to get again, right? And so that is the main motivation for writing the book, to to convey that sense of urgency against all these other books that are being written now from a more empirical perspective about how democracies end, how democracies die, post-democracy. I'm like, no, I need to kind of like defend democracy and show citizens that actually we need to do something about it and we must get it right. And so that is the first motivation. But this, another important motivation is actually the impression over these years that current academic debates on democratic reform are actually going in the wrong direction. It's like at this moment where it is really important, where citizens could use the help of scholars, experts in democracy, or practitioners, etc., the kind of proposals for reform that are the most popular among debates on democratic theory actually will not help citizens to overcome democratic deficits, but actually could make things even worse. So that was the other motivation of saying, oh my God, somebody has to say something about the dangers of thinking that we can't just take some shortcuts, some quick fixes for some problems that certainly democracies have, but that could actually take us away, even remove us more from the capacity of democratic control than we already are now. And so I wanted in the book to remind citizens of, well, at least democratic citizens, of what it is that it matters about democracy and how we should reject the temptation of going for shortcuts, for quick fixes that will actually give democracy away. So those are the two main motivations.
Yeah, that's great. I think on the latter point, especially, it seems to me there's been a lot of developments in political science and in philosophy that's sort of takes that, what's the name of the political science book, a realist take on democracy, so-called, that, you know, points towards the so-called inherent limitations on the part of the demos to rule itself. And, your book, I think, very plausibly sort of challenges these approaches. So I'd like to sort of dive in and see if you could, maybe if you could, as far as possible, lay out your main thesis here, and situate it, you know, in the main alternatives, as you say, in the literature, you know, what it would mean to have a democracy without shortcuts.
Well, okay, let's see if I can kind of focus on something in particular, because the book has so many strands, right? But in some sense, the main thesis of the book is that only a participatory conception of deliberative democracy can live up to the democratic ideal of self-government. So I'm very kind of ambitious in saying not only that a participatory conception of deliberative democracy is the most attractive conception among other alternatives, I'm trying to show that the other alternatives have actually failed, that they fail to live up to the democratic ideal under any minimally plausible description of that ideal. So in that sense, it's pretty ambitious. And so the way I argue is that I try to show in the first chapter that the ideal of the democratic ideal of self-government requires that citizens can identify with the political decisions to which they are subject and endorse them as their own. So that is my assumption about what the democratic ideal is all about. And so then I try to show throughout the book that this is only possible if citizens take the long participatory road of trying to convince one another of the political views they favor by changing one another's hearts and minds. Is that if the whole citizenry has to rule, there is no way around actually getting to convince one another of what way we want to go. And that is a long road, that is a hard road, but this is the only road. And the idea that we could, per magic, find some kind of shortcuts that will get us there is simply absurd. It's naive, it won't work. And in fact, I argue that the so-called realist point of view that is now so popular in political science, at least, is so extremely naive and non-realistic that it's just unbelievable. So that's kind of something I argue in the book in some of the chapters. And so what I try to show is that most popular proposals for democratic reform are actually trying to avoid the long road. They are trying to find shortcuts, some ways of getting better political results faster without having to actually face the problems and solve them. And the main problems, of course, which are real problems in democracy, are the deep political disagreements among the citizenry, of course, that makes it very hard to make decisions that get everybody along. The fact that citizens are ignorant of a lot of political facts and political issues, and also that we have a very poor quality of deliberation in the public sphere. That is a particular concern for deliberative Democrats. And so what I tried to show, what's wrong with all of them, with all of these different proposals, which are politically very different also. They are in completely opposed sides of the political spectrum, but what they all have in common is that they require or expect citizens to blindly defer to actors over whose decisions they cannot exercise any democratic control. And so in my view, to the extent that this is the case, if you can find the requirement of blind deference in a conception of democracy, that is not a conception of democracy, in the sense that you cannot explain how citizens who are required to blindly defer to the decisions of others, whatever those decisions may be, can see themselves as equal participants in a project of self-government. And so to the extent I use that as a criterion, as a kind of litmus test, to show that a minimal necessary condition for a conception of democracy to qualify as such is to not require that citizens blindly defer to the decisions of others over whom they don't have control. And with that criterion, then I show how the other three alternatives that I discuss, deep pluralism, plutocratic views, and epistocratic views, fail under that criterion. And so if we were to follow their proposals, we will exacerbate current democratic deficits instead of ameliorating them.
Yeah, that's good. And we're going to turn to the different models of democracy that you alluded to there in a second. I wanted first to just maybe dig in a little bit more into how you conceive of the notion of self-government or the minimal standard of self-government, which does a lot of work in the book and in criticizing the different models. I guess I'll put it in this way. Maybe you could connect for me how the standard of self-government is related to the notion of, as you just said a minute ago, blind deference. That is, why, you know, self-government requires citizens not to blindly defer. Because you may think that, well, in some ways, citizens might, you know, they might not be informed, but they might still see some kind of rationality or sense in the elite's decision. Or they may think that the elites who are part of their party, Republicans or Democrats, even if they don't quite know what's going on, they can identify with that in some sense. So I guess maybe if you want to say a little bit more about why it is that self-government, you know, necessarily requires citizens not to blindly defer.
Well, it's important to show the difference between, say, blindly deferring and deferring, because otherwise it may sound as if I'm saying that to the extent that citizens are not themselves making the decisions, then they are not part of a project of self-government. And so that's not like, my view is compatible with delegation, representation, having others deciding for you, perfectly fine. The difference between deferring to some actors and blindly deferring to them. And so what I argue is that the ideal of self-government does not necessarily require that I directly make decisions myself, right? That is a possible understanding, but it's not the one I'm following here. What I say, what matters is that I can endorse the decisions to which I will be subject as my own, in the sense that I won't be forced into blind obedience, that I can see why it's rational for me or reasonable to act the way that the law requires, right? And so in that sense, I should be able to identify with those decisions in the sense that those who may be doing them for me, those I delegate to. So imagine I select some officials from some political party that I identify with, right? So then I expect that they will make the decisions that I would have made if I had to make them directly. That's why I selected them rather than, say, the opposite, people in the opposite side of the political spectrum, right? However, the difference is precisely, imagine a case where those to whom I'm delegating, supposedly, or deferring for their actions, right, are such that I cannot assume that the decisions that they will make will coincide with what I will have done based on my own interests, values, and policy objectives, right? So imagine a case where I defer, but it's such that for all I know, the decisions of the actor I'm referring to could go either way. I have no way to know whether they are more likely to coincide with my own political values, interests, etc., or the opposite. That is what I call politically blind. Literally blind means that I don't know whether it will go one way or the other. Right. So I'm saying, if I have no way to know whether the decisions I will follow in any way coincide or are aligned with my own political values, interests, and policy objectives, then I am not a member of a project of self-government. I'm simply deferring blindly, and I have decided that I will follow whatever they say, which is fine. I mean, maybe there are good reasons to do so, and epistocrats may think that this is a great idea. All I'm saying is it's wonderful, but it's not democracy, right? So that's the minimum, that I'm not asked to defer to people who, for all I know, their decisions may have nothing to do with what I consider reasonable, whether I can accept them. Maybe they violate my rights, and I think they require me to act against my conscience. If I am in that situation, then I'm certainly not an equal participant in a project of co-legislation. And so that is why one can see that self-government rules out politically blind deference.
Yeah, that's good. That's helpful, because I was thinking that identifying with the people in charge could be have a cognitive element, which I think the one that you're stressing. I guess what I was thinking is it could have an affective character to it too, right? That you can, I mean, there are plenty of people who just blindly defer, but yet in the cognitive sense, but yet identify with the people in charge because they're just so passionately fired up about the rulers. So this is a sort of populist way. And so, I mean, that's helpful to distinguish that, because it's, you know, it's the epistemic kind of element that you're focusing on here, right?
Well, but not necessarily. I don't want to split the difference here that way, because yes, the cognitive is essential, but so is the affective, in the sense that if I identify affectively with a leader because I have the impression that it shares my values, my political views, right? Then that is the sense in which I'm trusting that the leader will make decisions that coincide with those that I find reasonable or politically attractive. So it's in both. I'm not sure that political alignment requires only cognitive alignment, right? Maybe also affective. The problem is, imagine I identify with a leader whose decisions then are extraordinary and unreasonable, and I cannot identify with them. I have no idea why they are reasonable, what they require me to do is acceptable, but I will do it anyway. Okay, that is the problem. That is where I see that maybe there are good reasons to do that. Maybe you think that that leader always makes right decisions and that you are an idiot and you don't know enough and therefore you just should blindly follow the leader. Okay, that is fine in the sense that one could do that cognitively or affectively, but one is no longer part of those who decide, is not part of those who are shaping those decisions. One is only subject to the law, but not co-author of the law. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was curious. I mean, you started this discussion about, you know, that you don't take a very rigorous conception of identifying with the law, which is, I guess, another, you know, on the other side of things. I was worried that your conception might be too minimalist, that it could incorporate. I see now why it's not, but you might think it maybe is not rigorous enough. I'm thinking of a kind of Rousseau type perspective who, you know, criticizes any kind of representative government on the basis that any kind of representation ultimately leads to the, you know, misalignment between the citizenry and government. So what's wrong with the sort of Rousseau approach there?
Right, but I think that the conception of blind deference helps to see why I think Rousseau is wrong too, because it's true that a direct democracy could satisfy the democratic ideal of self-government, but it could also fail to do so. Because in a direct democracy, if conflicts are resolved by majority rule, then the minority will also be required to defer to the majority. So it's not as if because it's direct democracy, you avoid the problem of deference. You have the problem of deference, and then the question is, what do you do about it, right? So long as there are disagreements among the constituent powers, so to say, then some will have to defer to others. And of course, Rousseau thinks that then whenever I see that I am in the minority, I should change my mind. And I should realize that I was wrong about what the general will requires. But this is a hard one, really a hard one, because I don't think that beliefs are up to us. I'm enough of a pragmatist to think that you cannot just simply change your mind on demand. Because in order to, and that is why the idea of being able to identify with the laws is important in my approach, because the idea is that in order to be on the driver's seat, in order to see why what you are supposed to be doing is reasonable, you need to see which beliefs of yours or which values, etc., need to be changed, which ones are compatible with what the law requires, say, right? And all of that has to make sense. You cannot just simply blindly change your mind, right? You need yourself being in, at the center of deciding which beliefs are compatible with the others that you used to hold, which ones need to be revised and why, what the reasons are, right? You cannot just simply, you can blindly obey possibly, but you cannot blindly change your mind because you wouldn't know what else you need to change, right? And so the idea that simply the majority decides that, I don't know, medically assisted suicide is ethically correct, and I just incorporate that and say, well, if the majority says that, it must be, right? But I don't know why. I don't know what else is incompatible with believing that. I don't know why I should believe that. Then that's not something I can do. And if I had to do it, then I need that reasons be given to me. So then I'm going into the direction of the view that I consider more important. It's not so much that I directly participate, it's that I'm able to influence and shape how the reasons in favor or against a decision are really the right ones or the most important ones or are inclusive enough, etc. That is what I think it matters. And I don't see that in Rousseau. I mean, he seems to have been very worried about public deliberation being helpful to discern what the general will requires. I don't think so. I mean, I think that consider public opinion, is what really needs to rule, even if it's wrong opinion. And so for that, it takes everyone to be participating who will later on be asked to obey the law.
Good. I thought, yeah, maybe it's good to get into the different models that you criticize based on this standard, these different models that are insufficiently expressive of self-government. You talk about three different models, and you referred to them earlier in the context of their kind of main concerns, which is the deep pluralist view, which sort of is animated by a worry about the deep and enduring conflicts among within a democracy, the elite epistocratic view, which is concerned about the cognitive deficits, I guess, of the demos, which I referred to earlier, and then the latocratic view or the deliberative democratic view, which is concerned about the sort of poor participatory quality of the demos, and so each one of these sort of is animated by those kinds of concerns. I come to different conclusions than you do, and take shortcuts, and so you object to each one. I thought, you know, if we're able to sort of lay out your concerns with each one, because I found them quite interesting, and it sort of cuts across the main approaches in democratic theory. So this was a really comprehensive book. Let's see, maybe which to begin with. I mean, we could talk about the deep pluralist view if that's most helpful to sort of set the stage in your view. So maybe you could just sort of say a little bit about the deep pluralist view and where you think it goes wrong.
Sure. Okay. So I use the notion of blind deference as the criterion to judge whether a conception of democracy qualifies as a conception of democracy. So in the sense that it gives us a view of the ideal of self-government that is plausible. And so the deep pluralist view as you said, is motivated by the idea that political disagreements among citizens run so deep, that's why I call it deep pluralism, that they cannot be reasonably overcome. We cannot expect citizens to come to substantive agreements about their political views so that then we just make decisions based on them. And so given this problem, which is a real problem, so I agree that disagreements run deep and they are hard to overcome. I just don't think that is impossible. That's, I think, the difference between the deep pluralist and the deliberative Democrat. But given the problem, which is true, that it's hard to come to agreements, what they propose is that we take what I call the procedural shortcut. So instead of trying to come to agreements, which is impossible and it's not going to work, and we just have to make decisions and we have to make them now, etc., then we should take the shortcut of democratic procedures. So since citizens cannot overcome their substantive disagreements, they should all agree on accepting the outcomes of democratic procedures, such as majority rule, whatever these outcomes may be, for the only reason that such procedures treat all citizens as equal. So you will accept it not because of the substance of the outcomes, but because of the features, the virtues of the procedure itself. The procedure treats everyone as an equal. It gives everyone who participates equal opportunities to influence the outcome. And because of that kind of like procedural agreement, so to say, then everybody should accept whatever the outcomes of those procedures may be. Now, the problem with the pure majoritarianism is that it requires that those in the minority blindly defer to the decisions of the majority, even if, for example, by their own lies, these decisions violate their fundamental rights or those of others. So the problem is that this type of democratic arrangement is incompatible with citizens in the minority, particularly persistent minorities, to be able to maintain their sense of justice. They may have to act against their conscience, they may allow to be wrong themselves or to wrong others, etc. And so that is a problem already from the point of view of justice, but from the point of view of democracy, the problem I see with the conceptions is that it fails to explain how those in the minority can come to identify with and endorse the decisions to which they are subject as their own, which is what the democratic ideal requires. And so the deep pluralist conception is actually a defense of rule of the majority, but that fails to live up to the democratic ideal of rule of the people. So they haven't told us how is it that this is a case of rule of the people. So that's my kind of main argument.
Yeah. So on that, I mean, just why conceive it of majoritarianism? I mean, I'm thinking, why not conceive of it, the deep pluralist view, as something like a kind of constitutionalist position? That is, that there's a sort of meta commitment on the part of the people to identify with the Constitution, which lays out then the procedures for the decisions on policy, that if the minority doesn't get their way, they can nevertheless identify with that outcome because they have a prior meta commitment to the constitutional arrangement that's sort of the condition for the possibility of any of the kind of, you know, reasonable, stable disagreements in the first place, right? And then they can, at some point, gather their troops and then, you know, hopefully persuade enough people for the next vote down the line in order to have the constitutionally appropriate outcome later on. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do see what you mean, but I think that is where the debate is. So, okay, let me...
Okay.
There are two components on what you are saying. So, on the one hand, you are saying, why is it that I cannot just simply accept that I lost, have a meta-agreement on procedures, and then if I'm not required to change my mind, like in the case of Rousseau, it seems you may be, if the pluralists agree that the minority continues disagreeing on the substance, but just simply accepts the decision because of a procedural pre-agreement, then why cannot they like fight the fight later, right? I have a problem with this, and I tried to explain it in the chapter, but I'm not sure if I just got it sufficiently clear. The problem is that we tend to think that we can take for granted the practices of disagreement and consent and contestation that we have, and just see what happens when we accept the procedural shortcut, right? I think that's not something we can do. And that's why I try to make clear in the book that the deep pluralist view is a revisionary view. And so it changes over practices. So you cannot rely on them. We have the impression clearly that we accept majority decisions many times. We disagree with them. And then, of course, we try to fight the fight later. And we try to actually convince enough people that this is wrong. And that way we may get the right decision. Okay, so that's a fair description of our current practices. However, our current practices are not predicated upon people accepting the procedural shortcut. And that's why you cannot rely on them if you are a deep pluralist. Because frankly, if it were true, if the citizenry at large became deep pluralists, which they are not, they will realize that they are accepting that no matter how wrong, substantively wrong a decision is, it is legitimate that it be imposed simply because a majority is in favor of it, regardless of the reason. Okay? So what you are accepting is that the reasons don't bear on the legitimacy of imposing it. Okay. If the reasons don't bear and it's only the numbers, then the minority does not really has any way, nothing that the minority can do really counts as fighting the fight, because the fight should not be fought. That is exactly why Waldron, for example, is saying that those who try through other means to undermine the decision that everybody should agree is legitimate for the reason that is procedurally correct are actually sore losers. They should actually accept that they lost, period. And that means they now obey regardless of what the consequences are, right? We don't do that. We have a fight afterwards because most people who are fighting the fight, who use substantive reasons to try to undermine the legitimacy of imposing that decision, think that this is the case, that substantive reasons bear on legitimacy. That's why we have a debate. That's why the majority feels compelled to have to give counter-arguments against the minority, when in fact, if only the numbers count, why would the majority feel compelled to be entangled on disagreements with the minority if that is not what the decision is about? You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm.
If the decision is legitimate, then it ought to stand, period. And if substantive reasons don't bear, if they cannot undermine legitimacy, then nobody should care. Like, the minority may want to fight a fight, but there is no fight to be fought because, you know, it's already okay with the majority as things stand. Now, when you say that people are committed to constitutionalism, that is a different issue because I agree. I absolutely agree that people are committed to constitutionalism. It's just that constitutionalism is incompatible with unconstrained majoritarianism. That's why I think that constitutionalism really much better represents where the majority of the citizenry is. So if I have a basic commitment to constitutionalism, to the institutions of constitutional democracy, that means that I reject unconstrained majoritarianism. So in constitutional democracies, majoritarian decisions that violate constitutional rights can be legally contested and overruled on substantive grounds, regardless of the number of supporters. So citizens that accept that a majoritarian decision in the legislature can be overturned, regardless of the numbers, are not deep pluralists. They precisely see that substantive reasons can undermine the legitimacy of that decision, even its legality, right? So they are not unconstrained majoritarians. And the institutions themselves, you cannot have judicial review if it were the case that the fairness of the majoritarian procedure determines the legitimacy and therefore the legality of the decision. Then there shouldn't be judicial review. And of course, that is what deep pluralists like Waldron are fighting against. If you are a revisionary like Waldron, at least revisionary for this country that has judicial review, you are arguing that people should take the procedural shortcut and reject judicial review. There should not be such a thing as undermining the legitimacy of a procedurally correct decision, majoritarian decision, based on substantive grounds where people disagree about them. That's what he thinks is wrong, right? However, I'm trying to show that if you really reconstruct the institutions of constitutional democracy, you can see that citizens are not the pluralists because they do believe that substantive considerations undermine the legitimacy, even the legality of decisions. However fair and perfectly conducted those procedures have been, that doesn't matter. So that's where the debate is between the deep pluralists and say that.
Yeah, I mean, your example, you used the example of same-sex marriage a couple times, which I think is a great sort of illustration of this point, right? Which is, you know, 20 years ago in the United States and elsewhere, you know, this would have been a minority position among public opinion, and so sort of contested, and if subject to, you know, just pure majoritarian pluralist view, it maybe wouldn't have, you know, gotten the kind of traction that it ended up getting in the subsequent years. And so based on the substantive critique on the part of citizens over years and pundits and journalists and academics and so forth got the substantive appeal to certain kinds of principles ended up swaying public opinion a great deal there. I guess I'm wondering, you know, I don't know if you think that's a good example to sort of illustrate it, but in that case, it seems to me that there's still a kind of tension between constitutionalism and maybe the sort of substantive deliberative view that you espouse. Maybe you can say why it's wrong. Because I'm thinking that, you know, okay, so say 20 years ago, if you were someone who wants to get married, but you were gay or lesbian and it's not allowed, how do you stand towards the law? What was the Clinton era law that's sort of the Defense of Marriage Act? How do you stand towards the Defense of Marriage Act? Is that is that illegitimate? I mean, I would assume that there's a way in which justice and legitimacy come apart here. But anyway, maybe you could say what you want to say about that. Yeah.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, the idea is that, of course, like the reason why citizens in Europe are not a deep pluralist, in my opinion, and even the deep pluralists sometimes recognize that, is because they think that injustice can undermine legitimacy, period. So they don't think that procedural legitimacy trumps every other consideration under any circumstances. I think it's a crazy view anyway. It's like, why? Why like that? You will have to be a fetishist about procedures to actually think that genocide could be justified. And so even the pluralists recognize that at some level of injustice, people are no longer going to be willing, or it's not reasonable to expect of them that they accept procedural fairness as the only consideration, right? Okay. And so, and the question I ask in the book is then, and so what are the options then in such cases? Okay. So the way I reconstruct and defend judicial review is by showing like what happens to homosexuals who wanted to marry and were confronted with DOMA and with many decisions at the state level of Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, against their claims that this was unconstitutional. Well, they had a venue, they had a way, like the unforced force of the beta argument is the weapon of the weak, right? The fact that it depends on substantive grounds and not on numbers gives an opportunity to minorities to make their case, right? If you have an institution that forces everyone to show what the arguments are, what the evidence is against the case that the minority is defending, you give an option to the minority to actually dismantle that evidence, to show what's wrong with it, to actually, there is a venue, there is a possibility to win, because it doesn't depend on simply the majority of the citizens changing their conceptions of the good or their religion or who knows what, right? That is something that a minority couldn't possibly achieve. However, a minority, if it has an institutional venue that allows them to ask for the reasons why that particular law is constitutional, why it's not discriminatory, what it is compatible with protecting the rights of all, then it can use that evidence. And in fact, that is what happened, right? By forcing the constitutional question on the ban on same-sex marriage, evidence needed to be shown, for example, about what was the compelling interest that the state had in banning it. Well, because of the concern on reproduction among families, because of the concern with kids that are born in same-sex marriage situations, etc. Well, that was used by lawyers to show that it's actually incorrect, that evidence is really crappy because kids that are living in same-sex marriage households do as well or even better than in other households, because there are families who cannot reproduce and still are families and are married, right? That can be a reason. So they could dismantle the evidence and try to make the case and convince the audience, the general public, that actually this is discriminatory and is not really acceptable, right? They could use substantive reasons to do so. If the only thing you have to, you can use is the numbers, is to see how many people are voting in favor or against, then you are done. Then you just have no choice, especially if you are a member of a persistent minority. You already know that there is nothing you can do. In those cases, Waldron will recommend secession. And I'm like, great, this is wonderful for territorial conflicts. If you have a real chance of succeeding in a secession conflict. I'm from Spain and Catalonians are not really so much having a shot anyway, but for non-territorial conflicts like same-sex marriage, transgender, like for all the conflicts we know, affirmative action, like secession is not an option, right? And then what is the option according to the deep pluralist? And I haven't seen any. As I say, it's either keep up or put up or give up. That's what the deep pluralist gives you. So I think that it's not a good reconstruction of the norms and the institutions we have, and it's a very unattractive proposal to change them. That's kind of my impression.
Yeah, you may take it, and I'm not sure if you address this in the book, but it occurred to me as you were talking, I mean, you may take it in a different sort of direction, which is, I mean, it strikes me that the sort of deliberative conception really relies on that assumption that you pointed to, which is that the unforced force of better argument actually changes things in politics. Like, you may contest that assumption if you're someone who has more of a power politics kind of outlook on the world. And maybe, I don't know if deep pluralists have this view, but you may have a different view that you need to be more, I don't know, take the more participatory side of democracy rather than the deliberative side, and get out on the streets and show your numbers rather than giving the unforced force of the better argument. Like, it seems to me actually the summer is a different view of democracy. I mean, it's not totally different, but a different kind of approach than you see in the same-sex marriage debate, which largely went through the courts, whereas this Black Lives Matter movement has really been sort of on the streets. And in any case, I raise that because the deep pluralist view, I guess, may be connected to a certain view that, well, it's just, you know, reason just doesn't get us that far. Sometimes you have to appeal to, you know, power and participatory right. power.
Right. But actually, I mean, I do have a section in the book trying to show, because that matters to me. This is the not so much some types of deep pluralists as the ones I was debating, but agonist views of democracy. They have the impression that that deliberative democrats are naive about power. And the real struggles for rights really are fought on the street. You show the numbers, you fight. Okay. And I'm like, okay. It's interesting because I did make it through a transition to democracy from a dictatorship. I'm very aware of how do you fight fights when you have nothing, okay? When you are really on the losing side, which I think is what agonists are always thinking about, but I wonder whether they are really thinking through what happens in those contexts. Like, what do you have when you are on the weak side and when you don't really have the power to bargain at all because nobody needs to listen to you? They can just simply either annihilate you or simply ignore you, okay? You can bargain. You can show your power when you have some power. That's what we see here, right? If whites join the Black Lives Matter movement and are on the street, if moms, white moms are on the street, that carries a lot of weight, right? But if young black men are the only ones showing up and at night, that doesn't carry the same kind of weight. So imagine we are all young men, blacks, right? And particularly in a dictatorship, for example, what power do you have? Do you really just have actual bargaining power vis-a-vis the powerful? No way. How had countries fought for human rights who were in dictatorships? In the book, I try to show what an amazing force the unforced force of the better argument is. If you can show your case, if you can convince others that you are right, those others may have much more power than you do. that is what happened, like Beth Simon shows it in the wonderful book on the development of actually human rights movements, how what groups that were really disempowered in dictatorships, for example, were able to try to capture the attention and the interest to their cause to people who were outside, to the audience outside their countries, vis-a-vis whom they only had the power of the argument. They had nothing else because those people were not affected. They were outside. They had nothing to do with what's going on in their country, so they could possibly be indifferent. So how did they manage to get them, to gather them, to join their cause and try to use their governments much more powerful against the dictatorships of those countries, right, to get them to, for example, sign up to human rights treaties, right? You can get that only with the force of the argument, means by trying to convince people that your cause is right. And if you can convince them, it can be the case, and it has always been in fights against rights violations, that others that are more powerful than you, but that could possibly have nothing to do with your cause, join it and decide to actually fight the fight. And they have bargaining power. They can make the powerful in your country to have to agree to, because they can impose economic sanctions. They can do, they have real power. Okay. So how do you get to convince them to join you? You can bargain with them. You can show power towards them. Those are like the global audience, for example, in the whole world, listening and seeing what happens, like whatever, in Lebanon, in Syria, right? Like those people, really, if they have anything, they could have only the force of the bad argument. The fact that other people who may be on the fence, who may not have pay attention to their cause, are actually paying attention now. By the way, that is what Black Lives Matter has done. And it's the example, like in my book, is before Floyd, but it's the same example. Because we have cellular phones, like because we have mobile phones, now we can show to people who are otherwise inattentive and somewhere else and don't care about the cause what's going on with police brutality, right? To me, showing evidence is part of deliberation. Showing the video and seeing what happened, right, is part of a debate on whether there is or there isn't police brutality in this country, right? And what Black Lives Matter needs and is trying to do, they don't make the mistake of the agonists of thinking that you should forget about the substantive cause and go only for riots. No, what they are trying to do is to get a huge audience, even in the whole world, supporting their cause because it's the right cause, not because they can bargain it or can threaten in them, right? No, they are joining it in Europe, in Australia, because it's the right cause, right? So to me, if one wants to explain how political fights are fought, particularly among those who have no power, right? Then I think the deliberative view, the participatory deliberative view, is in a much better position to explain how that happens. How do you enlarge audiences, make them join your cause, and use their power to help yourself out of your situation? I think that this can only be explained with the participatory deliberative view.
Yeah, I love that element of your book. It reminds me of the political scientist E.E. Schatzschneider, who has this view about expand, you know, when you get into these political conflicts and you might be losing, the strategy is to expand your scope. And it certainly works well with this deliberative conception. So that's great. All right. So the deep pluralist view takes this procedural shortcut, needs to take a longer road to follow your conception. I wanted to shift over to the epistocratic view, which I briefly alluded to earlier, which takes a kind of dismal view about the capacities of democracy, the capacity of democracy for self-rule, and insists on more elite rule, asks the demos to be more passive. That part of the problem with democracy is we have too much deliberation, right? We should be less, you know, deliberation just sort of divides us from one another, is pretty useless, and participation just, you know, empowers the activists who make us all more, you know, make it all more radicalized. Anyway, the demo should just get out of the way. Exactly. and let the elites rule. And I found your, you know, this has become a growing trend, but I found your critique just so perfectly persuasive. So maybe you could just say a little bit about, you know, where you think this view goes wrong.
Sure. Thanks so much. I mean, I'm glad that you found it persuasive. I'm hoping it will work. Okay. So The elite epistocratic view, of course, is in the opposite side of the political spectrum from the deep pluralist, right? The deep pluralist is participatory and thinks that anyone who decides anything against the majority is actually not a democrat. Okay. The elite epistocratic view is horrified of the majority and wants to make sure that the majority is out of the way and the minority, the elite few, can rule. Okay. And so what they show as the evidence all the time, the way they try to persuade somebody, I don't know whom exactly, I guess the lead, is by showing again and again how ignorant, politically ignorant citizens are. And so the idea is like, ordinary citizens do not have a clue, you cannot let them rule because they don't know what they are doing. And so they propose the expertocratic shortcut that simply will require that ordinary citizens trust and blindly defer to the decisions of experts. And so that we will all have better outcomes. And so the many will also enjoy the benefits of having better outcomes, right? And so obviously this proposal does not live up to the democratic ideal of self-government, but of course that wouldn't be an interesting criticism because they already know that, they actually hate the idea and are opposing it, particularly some elite epistocrats. Others are not, others try to be minimally democrats, but some of them, like Jason Brennan, just goes directly against democracy, period. And so that couldn't be the criticism. So what's wrong with it? It cannot be that it doesn't live up to the democratic ideal. And so the critique that I show in the book is based on what they really care about, right? They don't think that the democratic ideal has intrinsic value. And so for them, if anything, it has instrumental value, depending on whether it gives you better outcomes or not. And the idea is that epistocracy is likely to give you better outcomes than democracy, and therefore, since nothing is intrinsically valuable in democracy, then people should go for whatever gives you the better outcomes. So what I do is to take that ideal of better outcomes that the epistocrat shares and to show whether actually it lives up to that ideal, right, which is theirs. And of course, we all care about having better political outcomes. So if the epistocrat lives up to that ideal, then maybe we should join it. And so my critique in particular is that they are extraordinarily naive. I mean, they present themselves as realists. They say that the deliberative Democrats are naive, thinking that reasons and deliberation, they think we see democracy as a kind of philosophy seminar where people are just wonderfully giving arguments and that this is not what politics is about, and they consider themselves realists, right? But what could be less realist and more naive than assuming that a political community can afford leaving the citizenry as ignorant, xenophobic, racist, whatever it is that the elite epistocrats claim that they are, and yet get better political results? This is just mind-boggling to me. It's like, really? I just claim and try to show that, unfortunately, a political community cannot be any better than its own members. And so you can have the political elites passing legislation until they drop dead. But if they are trying to achieve these lofty goals of that the epistocrats tell us about, like non-discrimination and non-racism, freedom of religion, right? Like, I think that the elite could be passing legislation as it has been doing for the last 100 years, and nothing will change unless the citizenry actually change their minds, endorse those goals, the goals of whatever, non-discrimination, desegregation, whatever, and does its part, and therefore then we get the better results, right? But those real, like for them, is something like passing legislation is the goal. And I'm like, well, that could be a goal, but it is not helping. It's not the actual results unless you get the community to materialize those goals, right? So you can pass legislation. We have a wonderful constitution that prohibits discrimination. It has wonderful and endorses freedom of religion, but we still have segregated the schools. We still have discrimination based on religion. Like passing the legislation is not what matters. What matters is actually changing the minds and the hearts of the citizenry. That's why you cannot just get away of the citizenry, because it takes two to tango. So that's basically my argument, that they are extraordinarily naive, thinking that we could leave all the citizenry being xenophobic, racist, etc., and still get a non-xenophobic, racist society. I'm like, wow, this is believing magic. I don't believe in magic, unfortunately. So that's a very simple argument. This is my argument.
Yeah, I've trouble putting on my libertarian hat, but maybe just to try to do it here for a second. I mean, it strikes me maybe what they would say is something like, well, look, you can get those ends. You can change the minds and the hearts of the citizenry. There are other ways to change the minds and the hearts of the citizenry other than through politics. Like, there's a big civil society, and indeed, deliberative democracy puts primacy on the unforced force of the better argument. And you can have that in, you know, in civil society. And indeed, there's, you know, there's persuasion and shaming and so forth that go on in civil society. I guess the question is, why do you need to enshrine it into politics? I mean, so, you know, for the libertarian perspective, the problem is when, you know, more things get put on the political stage, there's more potential for conflict because more people want to try to get the goodies of politics, and it arouses more passion and anger. I guess you want more apathy. I mean, this is the part that really galls me, but it's kind of paradoxical. But you want more apathy, you know, more interest in capitalism, and I guess somehow through civil society it can change minds. That's the best I can do. I don't know.
Right.
Still, okay. Still might be magic, but what do you think?
Okay, so actually no, because they don't have the possibility of defending their epistocratic view and then recognize that one could change minds. So it is essential to buy into epistocracy that citizens' ignorance cannot be overcome. Because if you could shape the views, if citizens could help themselves into being educated and informed and not ignorant, then of course they could rule, right? Remember, the reason they shouldn't rule is because they are ignorant. And of course, that's not, as always, never enough for a normative argument. It's not enough that they are ignorant. It's that they can overcome the ignorance, right? So there's rational irrationality, and there are reasons, so to say, why they have to be ignorant, right? And so they cannot help themselves to say, oh, then I educated citizenry to do whatever I think is best, and then we do it, right? No, remember, we were going to be epistocrats, particularly, say, Jason Brennan, someone who really is against democracy, is against democracy because he thinks and defends that citizens are and need to be and must be, because of division of labor, et cetera, politically ignorant. And therefore, we need to have the few ruling in their place, right? So, no, you cannot help yourself to the idea that we could educate them. Because, of course, I mean, if they accept that, then they are in the same boat that we all are. I am in favor of educating the citizenry. I'm saying we need to change each other's hearts and minds, and there is no way around it. And only to the extent that we do, we get a better society, according to whoever at the moment thinks is that those results are better, right? And the fight keeps going. But then you are a Democrat, right? So the problem with the epistocrat is like it's in a very complicated situation, because it tries to argue as if their view was neutral and didn't need to be defended, right? So you may think that the market is better than having a big government, right? But the problem is that unless you convince the citizenry that this is a good idea and that they should live up with the consequences, right? If they don't endorse it, then you are not going to achieve that. Simply because, as Aristotle knew, for any form of government, the majority rules. You cannot rule against the majority, against the views of the majority in the long term, unless you are willing to infringe against the freedoms of citizens. That is the only way to do it. And of course, the problem is that what you want is economic libertarianism. It's going to be very hard to do so by authoritarian means that reduce the freedom of citizens, put them in jail. I mean, that is going to be a little bit self-defeating if what you wanted was economic libertarianism. But basically, it applies to their ideology as much to any ideology, that if you want it to be successful, you need to get the citizenry behind. Only when the majority actually endorses it and can live with the consequences and is willing to live with the consequences, then you have been successful at imposing whichever political program you think is the best, right? And so the problem is not whether we have big or small government. The problem is whether the majority is agreeable to live with the consequences. And so now we see the current populist backlash is showing that citizens are rejecting economic libertarianism. And they are actually endorsing economic nationalism, protectionism, etc., against unfettered markets as a reaction. So if you are Jason Brennan or anybody who wants to impose through a elite government a particular political program like neoliberalism, then the problem really that you face is that the majority tries not to like those views. And especially after they have been tried for a while, they don't really help the minority a lot. And so then they typically do not endorse them. And I think that is why economic libertarians tend to dislike democracy, because they see the problem that their views are not going to be popular among the majority of citizens anytime soon. And so if they aren't going to be, then maybe we have to impose them, which is fine. But then that can only be done, like any imposing. It doesn't matter whether it's libertarianism or socialism. I mean, whatever you want to impose, it will have to be by force, if it has to be. And therefore, it will go against freedoms of the majority. And so that's kind of where I see the problem. So epistocrats are stuck with shaping the majority of citizens as much as everyone else, as much as socialists, communists, you know what I'm saying? Like, doesn't matter. The thing is, like, the only way to get it done so that it's stable and continues over time is if you get the majority behind it. Once you get that, then you're fine. And this is not exactly democracy, but this is the part where epistocracy fails. They are only thinking of the decision makers, like give the power to the few decision makers I like, who are already convinced of what I think is right, and forget about the decision takers. And I'm like, no, the decision takers are the enablers. They are the ones who actually make it happen. And if they don't, then it doesn't happen. And then you are still where you were, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a remarkable sort of abstraction from politics, I think, at the end of the day. I mean, this is a sort of short way of putting what you're so eloquently saying. So let's shift over to the latocratic view, which is a view I think that it seems to me that you're closest with, which is the deliberative democratic views of, say, a Jim Fishkin or Helen Landamore, who, you know, develop a conception of how to conceive of democracy to sort of improve political participation through certain kinds of institutions like deliberative polls. I had Jim Fishkin on, gosh, mate, it's like a year ago now, about his new book, which you talk about in your chapter there. And so, you know, part of the idea is to sort of randomly select from the populace a representative sample of the people, have them spend a weekend to learn about the issues, and then poll them, as opposed to sort of taking the off-the-cuff, uninformed view of the people. This is what the people would have the opinion if they had the time to undertake that effort. And so the deliberative poll is supposed to give the citizenry a sense of what they would think, and to defer to that. So maybe you could say a little bit about, I mean, in your book, you criticize this view as also taking a shortcut, but build on it in certain ways. So maybe we could just start with, you know, what's the problem with this kind of view?
Right. So I'm sympathetic to some autocrats because they are deliberative democrats. So that's what we have in common. However, I am opposed to autocracy completely. Like I'm opposed from a theoretical or conceptual point of view, from the point of view of deliberative democracy, but I am also politically opposed. Like I'm horrified of the idea of taking away the right to vote of the citizenry, which is what it will take to have a autocracy, right? I'm horrified. I mean, it took me at least 18 years of my life to get the right to vote. And so I'm like, wait, don't you feel how dangerous this idea is? It's like you want to disenfranchise everyone first and then see whether it works. It's like, oh my gosh. So I'm not a autocrat under any stretch of the imagination. However, I am in favor of using deliberative mini publics. And so, but from the point of view of what the autocratic view is like, I think it also completely fails as a conception of democracy, for the very same reason, as I try to show, as the other views, however different politically they are. And so the idea is that if we take the autocratic shortcut, if you had an assembly of randomly selected citizens that somehow descriptively are similar to the citizenry as a whole, this is the idea, they think that they will make better decisions because they will be like us. They will be like the demos, right? They will be like the citizenry instead of being part of this political elite that has no connection with us and is unable to actually legislate what the citizenry wants. Okay, so that is the idea. But the problem is that the citizenry, once again, is expected then to blindly defer to the majority decisions of a group of random others, even if they have no particular reason to assume that these decisions will be aligned with their own interests, values, and policy objectives, so that they can accept them. So the problem even with Fiskin has been that they assume that the mini-public give us the considered opinion of the citizenry as a whole. But of course it can be, because if there are disagreements in the citizenry, if there is politics, if there is contestation about issues in the citizenry, that of course is going to be reproduced also within the mini public. It's like people are not going to stop being Republican or Democrats or whatever. Like they are going to have their fights on abortion, on whatever the topic is, on pensions, on whatever it is, right? So if there is pluralism in the citizenry, there will be pluralism in the mini public. And of course, as Fiskin knows, the question is that there is a majority. In the case of deliberative polls, it's particularly obvious because participants are not asked to come with one recommendation, which is great because that means that there is no danger that majorities are putting pressure on minorities or anything like this. So every single participant at the end of the weekend or the time that has been deliberating gives his or her own mind and opinion or recommendation and doesn't have to kind of come up with one agreed opinion. Okay, so that means that a majority of the mini public has one opinion and a minority has another. And so the problem is that we are asked to blindly defer to whatever the majority of those random others decides, regardless of whether it has any connection or will coincide with my own views, values, political objectives or anything, right? And so if you are willing to do that, that means that you are willing to give up on the democratic ideal of self-government, right? Because that means that you will accept those decisions regardless of whether you find them acceptable, whether they match your views, right? Nobody outside the mini public can know whether their views will coincide with those of the majority in the mini public or with those in the minority. Because both sides have been deliberating, have seen the information, have made up their minds, have done everything. It's just that some have come with one recommendation and the others with the opposite. And so then there is no good explanation of why anybody outside, which is like the citizenry as a whole, like think of like these deliberative polls have 15, 20 people, maybe 500, okay. But why should the 300 million people defer to those 20 instead of the other 10? Is completely puzzling to me. And I don't see how that could be democratic. So again, whenever I'm asked to blindly defer to the decisions of an actor about with whom I have no democratic control and no way to know whether their decisions are aligned with my own values, interests, and political objectives, then I am not a member of a political project of self-government. I'm just simply giving up and being willing to blindly obey.
So I'm wondering how much of your objection here has to do with, you know, the autocratic view per se, and how much it has to do with the particular, you know, design of a deliberative poll. Like, so I'm imagining, say, for instance, a different kind of autocratic institution, you know, like the ancient Greeks did. You know, you have a, you know, a deliberative body that's made up, that's selected bought through lot, right? So let's say our House of Representatives, you know, we pass a constitutional amendment and the House of Representatives, instead of being voted in, is selected by lot. Mm-hmm. So you still have a kind of like deliberative process that would happen. First of all, I'm not sure how many people would want to, want to be House of Representatives would want that, but let's just imagine it's true. Right. We already have a tough time enough to get people to go into juries through a lot. I don't know about being House of Representatives, but in any case, so there would still be deliberation and maybe the possibility of identification. So do you think would the objection still hold in that kind of case that there would still be a blind deference or do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because the problem is, like, no matter how you think of it, First, the idea that I have representatives that descriptively represent me in the assembly is wrong. Because political representation makes sense. Political representation means that people know what the programs minimally are, or what the kind of decisions are, what the projects are, what people want to do. And they may want to join it and feel represented by that political program for very, very, very different reasons, right? So I may be a male Illinoisan, and someone who is a female Alaskan may also think that it's actually good to have Social Security organized this way, right? There's nothing about your identity, your descriptive identity, that makes you want to have Social Security organized one way or another. Okay, so political representation makes perfect sense. People can identify with political programs for whatever reasons they believe in. Great. There is no such thing as political representation in a autocracy. So when people are randomly selected, typically either is a very big number to make sure that the random selection doesn't pick all males, for example, right? So it has to be gigantic to make sure that it's really representative of different socioeconomic status, gender, race, whatever, right? So the numbers have to be really big. Or it's a stratified random sampling, where you already make sure that there will be the same number of male and female, for example, whatever, or transgender, or whatever the case may be. Okay, so that is descriptive representation. So the idea that I'm being represented, for, say, for example, by the women in the assembly, doesn't make any sense, because the women in the assembly, for all I know, they could all be Republicans by coincidence, and only the males are Democrats, so I will not see myself represented in terms of the political program that they will defend. And also, the ones that are from Illinois may actually happen to be religious, and I happen to be secular, so I'm only represented by those who are in Alaska, but those happen to be male and not of my race. You see what I'm saying? Like, there is no such thing as the citizenry being represented by anyone in particular in the assembly, because there is no political representation. And so descriptive representation is a very poor indicator of representation, because people there, first of all, those who are participating in the assembly are representing their own views. They are not supposed to say, if you are female, you are not supposed to represent the views of women. Or if you are Illinois, the views of Illinois. You are representing yourself. You are part of the constituent power. You simply are a citizen. So as such, you are not accountable to anyone else, and you will make up your mind any way you want, as you do when you vote, for example, right? And so the problem is, given that situation, there is no sense. I don't even know what notion of representation is such that I will be represented by whatever the majority of that group decides, no matter what it is. Like, somebody has to explain to me, it can be for every citizen outside the assembly that their views coincide with those of the minority, a majority, right? It can be, because if it is a good representation and if there is a minority, right, some part of the population is represented by that minority, right? So it can be that we all agree, right? Unless it was a case where 100% of the members are in agreement, but that doesn't usually happen, especially with contested issues, right? So then, why will I, like, if those people are not accountable to me, why am I supposed then to blindly obey whatever they decide? I just don't see what the political story is about that. And nobody has been able to explain it to me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, here's the stab. I mean, you may think that, like, if you just think about the composition of the U.S. House right now, or the Senate, the people who are composed of it, I mean, as you say, there's a sort of, deficit in descriptive representation, but I think there's also a kind of substantive deficit there too. I mean, if you just take issues of, say, class, right? So it will probably be the case that, you know, people in a higher class will have different interests, values, and so forth, and in the lower class will have different interests, values, and so forth. But it happens to be the case that the current composition of the House of Representatives is all upper class, right? So, but if you have a autocratic selection of the House, you're going to get more of a representative sample in that sense of, you know, higher and lower class individuals. So that, you know, in other words, I mean, the point is, compared to what? Like, it's compared to what ends up being a kind of elite institution, you know, posed by elite who have particular interests, values that may be a sort of rule. I mean, I take it that's the ancient Athenian view is that it's a democracy by lot because it empowers the poor.
Right. Why don't we just empower the poor? I mean,
That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, going through the randomness, I mean, it doesn't do anything. The idea is that, do we feel that the current group of politicians do not represent the population? Okay, so why don't you impose quotas? Like, is the same as you will be doing with the so-called random, because it's not going to be random. Random is too dangerous. You may get really an impossibly non-representative sample by coincidence. So it's always going to be a stratified random sampling. Okay, so the stratifying is the same as the quotas. So if we think that we don't like political parties sending only representatives who are for a very small socioeconomic group, we could impose quotas as we have with being enough women, with being whatever. Like, we could impose quotas on people coming from different socioeconomic strata. You know, we could do that, but we wouldn't lose political representation, which I really think is essential, because it's not clear to me why am I being represented by a woman, say, that happens to have the opposite religious or political views that I have, right? Just because I got a woman there. So that's not against having women, but it's against losing political representation. So I'd rather have political representation means that people can choose political programs, which is what matters, and not personalities. And because of the fear that political parties are no longer representing us because they just have become professional elites, etc., then try to tackle that, right? Change that. Make sure the political parties are better, make sure that they represent more. But I don't see how losing political representation is a good democratic idea. I think that in Athenians, Greece, I mean, for very simple societies where there is not a lot of disagreement on political issues, etc., maybe it doesn't matter. But in complex societies like ours, with very clear different political choices and options for political programs, we need to not lose sight of those. And to me, that is what is lost if we just go for random representation. It's very unpolitical. It's a very unpolitical view.
Yeah. No, these shortcuts are different ways to sort of abstract from politics, and the point's well taken. Now, let's shift to the final part of your book, because time's running short here. When you talk about, you develop a conception of public reason that aims to sort of overcome the pluralist challenge and sort of redeem the promise of a participatory, deliberative conception of democracy, that a democracy without shortcuts can actually work. So you talk about judicial review, although we talked about that already. So I thought maybe we could focus in the last couple minutes here on the religion secularism divide, which has been a divide that's really sort of captivated democratic theory as something that seems to be intractable in a way, that the secularists and religious views and democracy seem to be kind of opposed and seems to be, you know, a dim prospect of overcoming that difference. So maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, how you conceive of, you know, a participatory, deliberative conception of democracy that maybe can sidestep those that what seems to be an intractable difference.
Right. That is also something important to me in the book, which is to undermine the impression that democracy is really for secular citizens. I am myself a secular citizen, as it so happened, but because I'm a European citizen and I see the problem that secularism is having in Europe, including religious minorities, I really think it's amazing to buy into the idea that there is a necessary conflict between religion and democracy. Because I see, if you look at European countries, a lot of the citizens who are joining these right-wing, xenophobic parties, etc., are secular ones, and they are really a threat to democracy, and they aren't any more Democrats than any other religious fundamentalist could be. So I generally do not believe that your secular or religious identity in any way is a better predictor of your political identity, of whether you are a committed Democrat or not. And so that was important to me. It was important to first make clear how hypocritical Europeans are, because I'm one of them. So I want to tell them, wait a second, because they are pulling the secular car to oppress religious minorities in the name of democracy. And that I find extremely hypocritical. So that was important in my book, although it's more for a European audience. But in general, I do believe that there is no necessary conflict between religion and democracy. And so, and if there is a conflict, it's the same for religious views than for secular comprehensive views. And so I try to defend how can it be really that we could, whether we are religious or secular, and if we keep our own conceptions of the good, right, without having to give them up, how could we actually solve conflicts? How could come to substantive agreements on fundamental issues, at least political issues, in spite of the differences? And so what I defend is what I call a prioritizing view of public reason, which is very different than the exclusion view that tells you, okay, exclude all religious reasons, and then you will see how you find agreement. I'm like, great, no wonder. Okay. Or the inclusion view, include all views, and then let the majority rule no matter what. That's deep pluralism, right? So I'm trying to find a view that doesn't require any of those options. And so all I'm trying to kind of highlight is that what is a commitment to democracy? A commitment to democracy is a commitment to treating each other as free and equal. It's accepting that everyone who is subject to the law has equal rights as you do to be a co-legislator. This is the hardest commitment ever. I mean, I'm not playing it down. It's really hard. It's the problem we are seeing with populism, etc. People cannot get their minds around to accept that whoever lives in the country and is subject to the law has equal rights to be a co-legislator. And we are having a very hard time believing that. Okay. But to me, a Democrat is precisely one who believes that. And so what does it mean believing that? Well, it means that for any legislation that you pass, based on whichever reasons you like, I also make it clear in the book that to argue in favor of legislation, typically you have to use comprehensive reasons, means religious, secular, or whatever, like conceptions of the good, because you are trying to explain why the law regulates practices that are worth having. Right? You need to know that, or else why would you care about that legislation? So you cannot avoid using religious or secular or otherwise comprehensive beliefs in order to explain why the legislation in question matters, why it should be this way or that way. And so that's fine with me. I think we have to have that type of debate, and it's perfectly fine. And we may have majority rule then, and so comprehensive views that are in the majority are likely to get their way. And that's fine with me too. It's just that if you are a Democrat, you have accepted that fundamental rights and freedoms should be equally protected for everyone. And that has priority over other considerations. And that structures a debate in ways that can be had among Democrats, of course. Those who reject equal rights or the Bill of Rights of a constitution, etc., those are a different kind. And I do not discuss that in my book because it will be too complicated. It's two different kind of discussions. But for those who are Democrats, they have already accepted that this type of consideration, whether or not a piece of legislation is compatible with protecting the equal rights and freedoms, the fundamental rights and freedoms of all the citizens, has priority over other considerations. And that discussion is not per se religious, secular, or anything. It's about the compatibility with equal rights and freedoms. And so that's something that anyone who is a Democrat can accept. And what I show as the two examples in the book, you mentioned already one, which is the same-sex marriage debate. I try to show how actually that is how it works. That's why it's so important to have institutions of constitutional democracy, because it helps citizens to focus their debates on that priority. That is what I think judicial review does if it works well. So in the case of the debate on same-sex marriage in America, for decades, the debate was about the meaning of marriage. It was about the practice, the value, the significance, the desirability of marriage. And this is a debate on comprehensive views and obviously could not be resolved to the like of everybody because there were disagreements. However, once this debate became a constitutional debate, once it became an issue of whether it is constitutional to ban same-sex marriage, which is a completely different question than what marriage means, right? Once you focus on that other question, it's fascinating to see how many citizens who were against same-sex marriage on the basis of religious views or other comprehensive views could not find convincing reasons to justify an equal treatment under the law. And so they actually, in an astonishing short period of time, they changed their minds on whether it should be legal. So an interesting, if you look at the polls, an interesting bunch of citizens changed their minds within a very short period of time on whether they were in favor of same-sex marriage or not. What is even more interesting is that a group within that group, and I do have the footnotes in the book showing it, they kept their religious beliefs. So they thought that same-sex marriage ought to be because they couldn't see a way to justify imposing their religious beliefs on others, right? So they kept believing that homosexuality is a sin, for example, and I do track the numbers in the footnotes, and they still thought that same-sex marriage was okay because they were focusing on a different question that having a constitutional debate helps a lot with, right? Namely, whether you have the right to impose it on others, whether you are discriminating on others who have different beliefs, right? Making that difference is essential to me to be a Democrat. And it doesn't take to be religious or non-religious to be able to do that distinction. And I think religious citizens can do that distinction very well. And in fact, the other example I use from Europe shows it from the other side, from the secular side. A lot of citizens are pushing the ban on using the Islamic headscarf in schools, in public spaces, right, for concerns of gender equality, right? So those are secular concerns, right? But now that it has been going through the Supreme Court, through the European Court, etc., citizens are beginning to understand that they can oppose the practice of wearing the scarf. They don't like it. They think it's not good, and whatever the heck they like, but they don't have the right to impose it on others, right? That's what the Supreme Court in Germany finally ruled against itself, against its own ruling, saying that it is discriminatory to ban the Islamic scarf in school, for example, right? So then you see, if you look at the comparison, you see how it's equally hard or not hard for a religious or a secular person to distinguish between their commitment for equal rights to others and their wish, of course, to have their conception of the good being generalized in society, right? You don't have the right to the second one whenever fundamental rights are at stake. Otherwise, yes, we have majoritarian decisions and therefore majoritarian comprehensive views always get their way. And we have the holidays we do instead of others, etc. But when it comes to fundamental rights, at least, we have to have that debate. And I think anyone who is a Democrat can accept the priority of protecting equal rights over other considerations. And of course, the fight about what it takes to do that is what politics is about. So I'm not saying that just by virtue of accepting the priority, we get the conflict solved immediately. No, we don't. But that is why we can, in principle, solve them, right? In a way that can be agreeable to everyone because we agree to those norms. We have the meta agreement on doing things that way, even though it may take forever for us to settle on what we think is the right decision, right?
Well, that's great. I mean, it's a nice note to end on that optimistic vision of democratic ultimate consensus. I love it. And I love the book, Christina. And I really want to thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much. No, it's a pleasure. It's wonderful to have this.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.